vaccines on the way. Still a long way to go.
Businesses like ours, just it's a really terrible trickle-down effect.
We'll really go out and start enforcing the curfew.
Enforcement is back, while the need for food at an all-time high.
It's heartbreaking enough to see the line start for our food distributions at 5 a.m., 4 a.m.
Police, come down now! Bring your children!
The fire data tracker and the search warrant.
It's not a raid. I mean, with all due respect, what you just said is editorializing.
The governor defends the operation.
You know, we're not in this. I'm not alleging that there was fraud or no fraud.
And a Miami congressman defends his support for overturning the election.
It's all this week in South Florida.
Good morning. Glad you could join us. I'm Michael Putnam.
I'm Glenna Milberg. As we come on the air right now, the first shipments of that vaccine are on the way.
In a matter of hours, the first doses are going to those on the medical front lines, along with long-term care residents, workers, and essential workers. Dr. Eileen Marty is with us now, the infectious disease specialist at Florida International University. Dr. Marty, great to have you again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you both.
Yeah. Dr. Marty, I have to say, after 9 months of grim news about this, I feel, and I think you probably feel, somewhat hopeful today, knowing that the vaccines are being shipped out and are going to arrive at the same time. Nobody can let their guard down for several months until it's widely available, right?
Absolutely right. And I am very, very excited about this vaccine, these messenger RNA vaccines. I've looked very carefully at the data that Pfizer provided based on the two clinical trials that are, by the way, they're still ongoing. The second clinical trial will go on for many, many months to come. And the data is very, very exciting. So yes, I am very pleased with the decisions that the FDA has made on Friday evening. And that, yes, we're going to have some vaccines here in Florida. But I think everyone should be very aware that where a number of 179,400 sounds like a tremendous amount of vaccine, that's actually very little compared to our population. So considering that we have to give two doses to each individual, we're talking about half that many people getting the vaccine, and out of our population of over 21 million individuals, that's less than 0.04% of our population.
Wow, that's certainly putting it into perspective. Dr. Marty, as we are speaking, I just want to alert everybody to look at the screen, because this is the Pfizer facility outside Kalamazoo, Michigan. Video of the first doses being packed up on that really cold ice and being shipped out. And this is really a moment in history that I think we're all participating in. The pandemic, of course, is one. And then this happening, just an historic effort to get this vaccine out. We'll look at a lot, to your point, on the efficacy and as well as the ongoing trials. We've seen all of these studies and polls. Is there going to be a willingness by enough people by next spring to take it, to make this effective in a way that everyone is hoping it will be?
Right now, based on the science, we need upwards of 70 to 75% of our population to willingly take this vaccine. We currently understand, looking at serologic studies, that despite the enormous numbers of people who have suffered from COVID-19 in the United States, only about 10% of our population has currently actually been exposed. And that is nowhere near the number of people that we need to have a protective immunity in order for life to go back to normal. So it's incredibly urgent that each and every one of us look for ourselves and realize that this is a very efficacious vaccine, and also that its safety margin is phenomenal, that the science has been done with superb care, and that I myself will willingly be taking the Pfizer vaccine.
Can I just one follow-up about something that I think we're hearing from a lot of people who are listening to what you just said and believe you and are ready to believe that this is going to work? The one variable that people want to know about is long-term effects. There's no way to know what the long-term effects are right now. How do you allay those fears?
So Glenda, thank you for that. That's an incredibly important question. And you're absolutely right. The study is a two-month study of the numbers of people who had received two doses and had gone beyond their 7 days post-vaccination, and that's where the comparison was. Whereas that could be something that we would worry about, the reality is that when we see side effects from vaccines, we generally see anything significant within the first 2 months. So it's not that it isn't possible, and it is absolutely imperative that we go on and study this beyond those 2 months for every single one of the vaccines that's being looked at. But within those 2 months is when we generally see anything of any significance, and rarely can we find anything of significance after 2 months for side effects.
Yeah, Dr. Marty, as you well know, there was a survey done of the 6,000 workers at Jackson Memorial Hospital, Jackson Health System, the other day, and they found that 49% said that, yes, I'd be willing to take the vaccine. About 35% said, okay, I'll consider it. 15% said, no way, I'm not taking this vaccine. Now, I know the chief medical officer at Jackson says, yeah, I'm okay with those numbers. I have to say, I find them low for people who are exposed to COVID-19 and coronavirus, you know, on a daily basis, that more people are not saying, yeah, give me the vaccine. What's your reaction?
I think there's been a lot of misinformation transmitted on the internet, a lot of reasons why people are confused as to the validity of these vaccines. And there have been, historically, back when we, in the early days of making vaccines, when we were less sophisticated, there were problems. And so we have to see where we are now, where the science is now, and also compare the risk-benefit ratios. When you think about the risks from taking the vaccine, which are virtually none, very, very little, very minor reactions that we're seeing, especially in the older populations, virtually no reactions, you have to compare that to the risk of this horrific virus, and not only the risk of death, which is unbelievably alarming and tragic, but also the risk of severe complications for the rest of your life from getting the wild virus. When you compare those things, I think it's a no-brainer. Yeah. Take this new messenger RNA vaccine.
Just if I may, a follow-up. We know that former Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have all said, we will on camera get a shot and show the American people that we believe in it. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that way back when we were doing things very primitively, variolation, which was actually using smallpox to vaccinate in a way or variolate people against smallpox, George Washington had Martha Washington publicly be variolated to get the troops to be to take that product. So it's a long history of having the right messengers.
A doctor and a historian. So let's bring it back to the here and now, because we still, with this vaccine and this historic moment that we are participating in together, we're still in the midst of a pandemic. And in fact, we got the White House Coronavirus Task Force report, thanks to our friends at ABC. We've been getting this from the network there. This is not something that's disseminated by the state. And this one, I'm guessing that you saw this, that I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. So these are the numbers from after Thanksgiving week, 2 weeks ago. In the red zone, this state is, by all metrics, Dade, Broward, Palm Beach County, not Monroe this time, but in the red zone. And by all metrics, we're having a surge that is frightening and dangerous. So while we wait for the rollout of the vaccine, the messaging is the same. The messaging is more urgent, it sounds like, and people need not let their guard down, and I'll let you finish that.
100% agree with you. We are in a very serious condition right now in South Florida, as we are in the rest of the United States. And it is absolutely imperative that all of us use the masking, the distance, the hygiene, and the avoiding crowded places and small gatherings when gatherings happen, where people keep up these practices. It's something that, even though we're rolling out the vaccine, especially when you consider the small relative numbers of doses that are available right now, and even people who are vaccinated are going to continue having to use the mask until we get that population of 70 to 75% or higher vaccinated.
Yeah, Dr. Marty, very quickly, the White House Coronavirus Task Force findings from December 6th were released thanks to a public records request. And that task force, the recommendations are saying, come on, Florida, you've got to do better. Either close or really restrict any indoor dining, close all your bars, make mask wearing basically mandatory. Do you hope that, in fact, the governor is going to heed that message?
I hope that the governor understands the gravity of the situation for Florida. I know that the governor is looking at trying to look at all the interests of Florida in a comprehensive way. And so I understand that there are economic issues and we have to pay attention to those, but we can have an economy and we can take care of managing this virus if we set the right example and if we give the right message to our population.
Messaging key at the moment, Dr. Eileen Marty from FIU and the woman who taught me to wash my hands really well. We're always glad to see you. Thanks so much for your work.
Thanks, Dr. Marty, as always. All right, next, Florida has only one Democrat elected statewide, Agriculture Secretary Nikki Fried. She is pushing back on a host of moves by the governor.
Guess what? Nikki Fried live with us when we come right back. Stay tuned.
Nikki Fried is the lone Democrat elected statewide, and she is often the main voice of opposition to DeSantis administration policies, and she was that voice again this week.
Florida's Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services has been critical of the governor's direction on COVID health and safety, and she was one of the first to defend the former state data analyst, Rebecca Jones, who was served with a search warrant this week, who posted the video from that FDLE operation all over social media. Nikki Fried is with us live via Skype today from Jacksonville. Good morning, Commish. Great to have you with us.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. It's so good to be with you all. Today is my birthday, so it's even more special.
Happy birthday.
Another
year.
Friends and family.
Another year more fabulous.
Feliz cumpleaños. We wish you a happy birthday. Commissioner, let's begin here with the Rebecca Jones incident where the FDLE agents went to her home, and even though, you know, the allegation is that she somehow hacked into the State Department of Health computer system, she's a data analyst, and yet we all saw the guns come out as the agents went in, although there was no threat from her, and you issued a strong statement condemning that. So what was wrong? What did the FDLE agents do that angered you and concerns you?
Look, you know, as most people know, I'm a past public defender and had clients that were accused of much more egregious crimes that were met with less aggression. And I'm certainly not here to, you know, really criticize the frontline officers, and I appreciate all that they do. But any time that you see a situation like this and you see guns pulled where there's children in the house, it's very alarming. But I also want to get everybody back to how we got here, how we're here in the first place. And that goes back to the transparency and lack thereof of Governor DeSantis. If he had ever been open and honest with the citizens of the state of Florida, Rebecca Jones doing her job, trying to bring light to some of this. And the reality of the situation was he has lacked leadership day one. And that's what we got us here for. It's because of his lack of transparency and his data spinning all along this.
In the absence of someone to rebut and refute, let me just play devil's advocate for a moment here. I want to go back to the actual operation. I will say, having covered police operations and search warrant services, search warrant service is one of the most dangerous things police officers do. We have been privy to, thanks to FDLE, the sort of the other side of the story. The officers we saw really doing what protocol says they should do. Rebecca Jones didn't open the door for them for 13 to 17 minutes. And so their guns drawn is actually protocol in what they were doing. They were exceedingly respectful to her. And to your point, the reason they were there was because they were serving a search warrant on something she may or may not have done. She denies it. But what is inappropriate about that?
You know, once they got into the house and she was very clear that there was children inside, you know, I have three young stepsons. And I know that in a time when, you know, they're running around the houses and they're playing hide and go seek, and you have, you know, big banging on the front door, and now you have cops coming into the house, that they're scared. And who knows that they could have jumped out of a hiding place behind a closet, run down the stairs really fast. And having those guns drawn, even in a, you know, executing a search warrant and a nonviolent crime, there has been no allegations that there was ever weapons in the house or that she has any past history of, you know, anything with weapons involved, that you take some extra precautions. And, you know, unfortunately, I, you know, have questions of whether or not that was appropriate, knowing that there was children in the home. And none of us want to see that. But again, I go back to how we got here. And we need to be able to flip this and understand that Rebecca would have never been fired if she hadn't stepped up and tried to make sure that there was transparency, that the citizens of our state were actually getting accurate information from the Department of Health, because they've lost faith and trust in Governor DeSantis. And, you know, certainly, you know, definitely do not condone any type of criminal activity, and really appreciate, you know, our frontline officers. But when children are involved, you've got to take those extra precautions.
Yeah, Secretary Fried, I think that I could say objectively, Governor DeSantis has not been very transparent in releasing data about COVID-19, or he's tried to spin it to look more positive. Not sure why. Maybe he's trying to please President Trump. In any event, the December 6th White House Coronavirus Task Force report, which we have now seen, says that Florida just simply has to get much tougher in the fight against the virus, that indoor dining should be ended, perhaps, or much more limited. Masks have to be worn, maybe enforce fines against them. Bars should be shut down. You know, have you had a chance at a cabinet meeting to say to the governor, come on, governor, do some of this stuff?
Yeah, you know, first and foremost, the governor has canceled a great majority of our cabinet meetings this year. And then every single time that I've asked for something about COVID-19 updates, conversations amongst the cabinet, requests for those to be onto the agenda, he has denied all of my requests every single time. I've had an opportunity at the end to, you know, say something. He has not responded to any of my requests. And, you know, this goes into line of just his lack of leadership here. And our local governments, you know, are trying to do what's best for their communities. And he's even banned our local governments from doing what's best, whether it's mask mandates, whether it's trying to limit exposure inside of restaurants and nightclubs, to even curfews. And he has said, nope, it is his way or the highway. There will be no mask mandates. There will be no pulling back of regulations. His vision of what is happening in our country and our state and our country is vastly different than what is really happening out there. And we've got tens of millions of people across our state and across our country that are still scared, that are in very centers where they're seeing it upticks, and people that are really getting sick and dying, unfortunately. We even saw one of the University of Florida basketball players this weekend collapse on the field, on the court, and they're saying that it is because of remnants of having COVID-19.
Commissioner, I want to bring it down, targeting something that's in your lane, the agricultural industry in Florida, statewide, especially in South Dade, too, in our part of the town. $50 billion impact so far from COVID, 34% decline in financials. Later on in this program, we're going to have the president and CEO of Feeding South Florida, who gets a lot of the supplies from the farmers and growers who are now hurting for their own markets. And then we just had a deadline on Friday for them to apply for relief. Bring us up to date on the status of that relief, which we're still waiting for Congress to do, and the progress of how they're going to recover.
Sure. First and foremost, our agriculture community and our growers and producers are some of the most resilient in the entire country and the world. They go through droughts, they go through hurricanes, but COVID is something that we've never seen before. And so we saw actually $500 million worth of losses between March and April when most of the food service industry shut down, whether that was restaurants, our theme parks, to schools, cruise line industry. And so we saw those, but we pivoted very fast inside the Department of Agriculture, started an online marketplace for our producers to kind of put everything on there. The consumers went directly online, really saved a lot of our agricultural growers and producers along the way. And so now they're relying a lot on the federal dollars that have obviously been very slow. We were trying to get some of those dollars down back in March and April, and some more freedom and flexibility on purchasing powers from our food banks. But unfortunately, that was slow to come down too, and didn't receive any of that until about May, June, when most of our harvest was done. So as agriculture now is preparing for the next harvest, they're seeing the upticks, of course, in all of our food supply chains kind of decrease still, and all of our food bank lines going around the corner. And they're doing their part. They're donating a significant amount to our food banks. But we need that federal assistance come down sooner than later. Our food banks are just not able to keep up. We keep telling people, please volunteer, please give, please, whether it's financially or go and give different cans of different food, please, to our food banks. Everybody is in need. And unfortunately, when we saw 3 million of our citizens across the state of Florida food insecure, that was before the pandemic. And that, of course, is increasing every single day as our unemployment numbers continue to rise. And a lot of those jobs, especially in kind of the tourism industry, is just not going to come back.
Well, food scarcity is huge, and it's a big concern of yours, we know. Secretary Nikki Fried, great to speak with you. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And please, everybody, mask up, wash your hands, social distance. The message isn't coming from the governor. At least listen to your local and other leaders out there. Please mask up, wash your hands, social distance.
That message is coming from a lot of people.
All right.
Stay
thank
tuned,
you.
Everyone. Roundtable is next.
We have got a lot on our plate this morning for Roundtable, that raid on the home of the health data analyst in Tallahassee, governor who says it wasn't a raid, a congressman who supported an effort to overturn the election.
We have a reporter roundtable today with two veteran Florida journalists. Both are now opinion columnists. Nancy Ankrum is the editorial page editor of the Miami Herald. Steve Bosquet is an editorial writer at the Sun Sentinel with an emphasis on state politics in Tallahassee, as a matter of fact, as we speak. Good morning, everyone.
Nancy, Steve, great to see you. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. If we could, we want to begin by getting your opinion about Representative Mario Diaz-Balart of Miami, who was one of 126 Republican members of the House who signed on to a friend of the court brief that essentially tried to overturn the election in four states and have the Supreme Court tell the legislatures in those states that in fact they could pick their own electors and thus make Donald Trump the president. Nancy, what was your opinion when you learned that Representative Diaz-Balart had signed on to this?
I think there was no surprise there. He has been a staunch Republican. He has been in lockstep with past Republican administrations and this one especially. So there was no surprise there. I think that it would be much more difficult, take much more backbone, of course, to stand up and refuse to sign on than to acquiesce. However, I'm not quite sure he acquiesced. I think he probably did so willingly without feeling any pressure. I was not surprised at all.
Steve, weigh in.
Disappointing, disgusting. I've always had a high opinion of Mario Diaz-Balart, and I covered him here in Tallahassee for a long time. He, of all people, should have known the risks of political meddling in something like this, because Mario Diaz-Balart was here in Tallahassee 20 years ago this month when there was an effort, unsuccessfully it turned out, gladly, to basically have the legislature override, you know, of the vote of the people and force George W. Bush in before the courts had resolved all the legal issues. Bush ended up winning, of course, but, it, you know, it's probably still in dispute by a lot of people. So several news outlets, I think of Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post comes to mind. Some news outlets have listed in print every member of Congress who signed on to this betrayal of democracy.
You know, I think it's appropriate to, we have, Michael did an interview with the congressman yesterday, and he speaks for himself as to his reasons. Let's take a listen.
What I want to do is protect the Constitution and the rule of law. Look, if there was a U.S. Senate vacancy in any state like Florida, and let's say a federal judge or a state judge or the state legislature tried to put their person in there, I think you would be outraged. And it would be pretty clear that the reason that doesn't happen is because the Constitution gives that power, not to the legislature or to a judge or to your next door neighbor. The Constitution gives that job, that power to a governor. In the case of what we're talking about here, it's pretty clear on its face that states like Pennsylvania violated the Constitution and therefore did something that is unlawful. The Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Subsection 2, grants state legislatures the appointment of electors in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. So you can't have, in the case of Pennsylvania, a state court change the rules of an election because the Constitution gives that power only to the state legislatures. So what we're talking about here is protecting the Constitution and the rule of law. Just like I know you would be outraged if in an unconstitutional
manner. All right, well, that is what the congressman told me, and frankly, I thought I had fallen down the rabbit hole because I kept trying to say to him, but what is really at issue here is subverting the will of tens of millions of voters and throwing that out. And he's talking about defending the rule of law and the Constitution. I mean, I just, you know, this is just sort of, frankly, political gobbledygook.
And let's not forget, there has been absolutely not a shred of evidence in any of these states. I mean, if we have reached the point where Trump toady William Barr is defending the integrity of the elections, then again, yes, this is political gobbledygook and an attempt to subvert the Constitution, not uphold and protect it.
You know, I have a quick question based on what the congressman just said. Steve, if it's the legislatures that need to change the rules, didn't Governor DeSantis allow this state to start counting early the absentees if the counties wanted? I mean, he kind of change some rules to make the counting easier and better. Would that be the same? Is that apples to apples?
Yeah, you know, it was actually I went back and researched this before the election. It was actually the legislature that last year, when they passed that controversial law that had to do with the implementation of Amendment 4, the voting rights for felons, buried in that bill is language that basically says supervisors of election can begin to canvass, tabulate, mail-in ballots 22 days before Election Day. This is to a large degree why we had this, I'd say, smooth landing in Florida that you didn't see in other states. So that for all the bad things the Florida legislature has done over the years about voting and voting rights, this was one of the good things they did.
It certainly was. Yeah, it made it possible that on the night of November 3rd, the elections departments in 67 counties had figures available. I mean, it was really a remarkably good job after many bad jobs on election nights. We had a good one. If I can, we're going to kind of pivot here, and I want to ask you both to weigh in on the Rebecca Jones situation. Steve, you are in Tallahassee. You've reported from Tallahassee for years. When you saw the video of the raid on Rebecca Jones, and there she is, on her home with the agents going in with their guns out, pointing them upstairs, not at children. She claimed they pointed them at her children. What did you think?
Well, the early images, you know, it looked like an overreach for sure with the guns drawn. I heard the comments that Glenna made earlier in the broadcast that that's standard protocol, and that's what FDLE is saying. It's their standard protocols. And of course, they've said now that they called the home repeatedly and they knocked on the door and they used restraint to try to, you know, get compliance here. You know, we're talking about seizing cell phones and computers from a young woman, a young mom who's home first thing in the morning. What's happened here, Michael, is that DeSantis has completely lost control of the narrative and the message of this situation. That that outburst on Friday in Tampa was uncalled for, in my opinion. Talking about DeSantis with finger pointing and accusing a reporter of editorializing. We've come to this. DeSantis has started to pick and choose with more aggressiveness the forums where he chooses to answer questions. Mm-hmm. And he'd rather be on Sean Hannity's show or Mark Levin's radio show than do a press conference with the media in Florida.
Okay, and can I just want to interrupt you because we have to go to break. But just to your point, I just want to mention we invited Rebecca Jones many times. She has not responded to us. She does go on national media on CNN and MSNBC, whatnot. And I just wanted to point out that in Miami-Dade County, the school police accused a teenager a couple of months ago of blocking access to the school virtual platform. And there was a quote-unquote raid at his house in Miami with gun-wielding police. And it's a very similar apples-to-apples situation. All that said, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Roundtable.
Welcome back. We are in the midst of a very good roundtable with Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor, the Miami Herald, Steve Bosquet, formerly a reporter for the Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, now the St. Petersburg Times, Tampa Bay Times. I want to go ahead and have the folks at home hear what Governor DeSantis said on Friday in that kind of testy exchange with some reporters. Here it is.
I knew there was an investigation. I didn't know what they were going to. And it's not a raid. I mean, with all due respect, what you just said is editorializing. It was not a raid. They were serving valid process in accordance with the laws and Constitution of the United States and the state of Florida.
Come outside.
Well, I don't know. In my opinion, and Glenna and I have been reporters for a long time, and Steve and Nancy, you have been too. That was a raid. I mean, there's no question about it. Those guys went into that home and, you know, generically it was a raid on her home. But the larger issue, Steve, is the governor's attitude. I mean, he's getting very aggressive and he won't talk. I mean, we invite him to be on this program almost every week. He's just not talking to reporters.
No, he's not. I just recently looked at a whole email dump from his staff in the governor's office, and it's a CNN has tried for months to get him to be on their program to no avail. Something interesting is coming up in a couple of days. On Tuesday, for the first time in months, the cabinet is meeting. And as luck would have it, the FDLE commissioner, Rick Swearingen, is on the agenda on routine matters. But he's going to get, I hope, if the system still works, Nikki Fee will be there. You know, this is the time for Swearingen to explain exactly what happened. There's even the possibility that the agents who executed the search warrant may be there in person to address some of these questions. What we can't have in Florida is any even perception that the state's largest law enforcement agency is being used for any sort of political purpose. We had that in the last administration when Rick Scott single-handedly fired a former FDLE commissioner, as you remember. Mm-hmm.
But of course, that is the perception. That is exactly the perception. And this is an administration that's not pushing back very hard to dispel it, to the point where we see FDLE not releasing the search warrant, but the affidavit for the search warrant. Usually investigations are held a little closer to the vest. And so I would hope that Nikki Fried would ask those questions also. As far as DeSantis not appearing on either this show or responding to our entreaties for an interview, that is a well-worn and successful Republican MO. Rick Scott did not answer our questions, did not get back to us beyond, I think, our first interview for him. And it has been a winning formula. Yeah.
Can I just, before we go on, I want to really dispel the perception that we're piling on anywhere, because there is really good questions about how this has turned into a he said, she said, about what Rebecca Jones did, why she was fired for insubordination, mm-hmm. was what the numbers she has, what she's done. She was a mm-hmm. state employee, and I think, you know, to your point, I would love to hear firsthand answers from those elected officials involved, but I think it's very important for us to maintain that healthy skepticism that all this may have a very different third story eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, I would just like to put it on the record that my feelings aren't hurt that Governor DeSantis won't appear on our show. I regret it. But on the other hand, when Daniela Levine Cava or Steve Geller or mayors of other cities try to contact him, Mayor Suarez of Miami, a Republican, he isn't taking calls from them. And that really is important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, there's been a noticeable decline, collapse in the quality and quantity of communication between the governor's office and the elected leaders in South Florida that we all know have the most serious challenge dealing with this pandemic.
They do.
But at the same time, I think this is bordering on evil. We have seen that Governor DeSantis is not interested in mask mandates, closing down restaurants again. But to tie the hands of the municipalities, of the city leaders, I think borders on evil.
Nancy Ankrum, Steve mm-hmm. Bosquet, it is always great to have you both with us. Thanks so much for your
time. Thanks. We'll continue to read you in the Herald and the Sun Sentinel. Good to be friends as well. All right, up next we're going to talk to, thanks, Paco Velez, the head of Feeding South Florida, which is swamped with customers.
And running short of cash and possibly food. Stay tuned. That's up next.
The toll the COVID crisis is taking on South Florida is evident in the long lines of cars waiting for free food at distribution centers around South Florida.
In fact, the need has more than doubled, and now the food supply may be in jeopardy. Paco Velez is the president and CEO of Feeding South Florida with us today via Skype. Paco, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you have been so busy.
Paco, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you guys for having us.
So first of all, let me just say on behalf of Local 10, we salute you, your staff, your volunteers. You're just doing tremendous work. The question I really think we all want to know is, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel financially. You got $50,000 this week from Wells Fargo. God bless them for that. But, you know, what is your financial situation?
So we're working to try to bring in as much food as we can. As most folks know, the CARES Act is expiring at the end of December. And the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, which is a program off that CARES Act, we finished that product or that program a week and a half ago. So now we're looking to purchase as much product as we can to bring it in with that decline in food. We're looking at with the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program going away and trait mitigation product going away, an 8.4 million pound per month decline in food starting in January. So we're doing everything that we can to purchase as much product now so we can have it ready for the rest of December and early January. We just pulled the trigger on almost $1 million worth of product.
So when you go to purchase the food, this is not a South Florida problem, it's a nationwide problem. Everyone's looking for food. Where do you purchase it from? You know, we spoke with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried in this program talking about South Dade farmers and growers trying to provide, hurting themselves. Where does the food come from?
The food comes from all over the country. We work with distributors and manufacturers from all 50 states to figure out the best price and who has the product. Some manufacturers have 3, 4, 5 week lead time. Some of them have 8 week lead times, which means we're going to have to wait. So that's where we try to find those vendors. And we're in competition with grocery stores. We're in competition with other food banks and other vendors. So we're working hard to do this immediately so we can have food for the rest of December and early January. So it comes from all over the country.
Yeah, Paco, I saw an amazing statistic in the Washington Post the other day, and an alarming one. They say that one, and this is from the U.S. Census data, 1 in 8 Americans is not have enough food every day. And in households with children, 1 in 6 of those families, they have children who are hungry during the day at some point. You know this firsthand because you serve those families.
So locally and in the Feeding America Network, we're actually seeing much worse numbers. We're seeing actually 1 in 6 adults who are struggling with food insecurity. Wow. and 1 in 4 children who are going to bed hungry. And we see that every day here in South Florida. The U.S. Census releases these pulse surveys on a weekly basis, and we're at the very top of almost every single one of these issues, from food scarcity to housing insecurity. And if you know, there are categories, we're second worst, just below Houston. So which kind of coincides with the size of our food bank. Houston has the largest food bank in the Feeding America Network, followed closely by Feeding South Florida.
Can you, Paco, talk about why that might be? Why is South Florida? I mean, the income disparity is in everyone's face right now. We have multi-gazillionaires living here and people who have to choose between their electric bill and groceries. And that's something that we grapple with every day. But why is the food insecurity and housing insecurity so bad here compared to everywhere else besides Houston?
So South Florida, first and foremost, has a high cost of living. We've had these issues even before COVID. We were serving 706,000 individuals from Palm Beach down to the Keys. And COVID just made the problem even worse. But we are a destination spot. Folks come here for tourism, for vacation, or to catch a cruise ship to go somewhere else. We're heavily in the hospitality, hotel, restaurant, the cruise line. We have 3 major airports, Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade. A lot of these industries have been impacted, along with department stores, and the arts, nonprofits. So we are heavily in the industries. We rely heavily on these industries, and a lot of the industries were forced to either shut down or to furlough people. Hence, a lot of the families that were struggling a little bit before are now struggling really to put food on their table or keep a roof over their head.
Mm. Yeah, Paco, we know that there are many of our viewers of This Week in South Florida of Local 10 who are tremendously generous, who would like to help Feeding South Florida. How can they help you? Where do they go? To your website? What would be the best way to help, you know, you feed people in South Florida?
For anybody seeking assistance and for anybody looking to provide assistance monetarily or coming out to volunteer, feedingsouthflorida.org is the best way to get involved or to seek assistance. South Florida community has been extremely generous, whether it's a hurricane, a government shutdown, or now this pandemic. Folks have come in to volunteer, and folks have continued to donate their funds, right. and we hope that they continue.
I beg your pardon. We are out of time, but we hope that people will go to the website and will volunteer and will contribute. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you both.
We'll be right back.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us here. We're online, as you know, 24/7 at local10.com.
And remember, as always, stay informed, get involved, and go Dolphins. Beat those Chiefs.